In a sense, it already has. Remember, we are no longer the generation of the good enough marriage. We are now looking for our soulmates. And even after we find our soulmates, if we start feeling unhappy, we get divorced. If you are looking for your soulmate, now is the time to do it. Consider the rich social infrastructure of bars, nightclubs, and restaurants in cities. Add to that the massive online dating industry. Then throw in the fact that people now get married later in life than ever before and spend their 20s in early adulthood, which is basically dedicated to exploring romantic options and having experiences that previous generations couldn't have imagined. College, finding our careers, moving out on our own to different cities and parts of the world. In early adulthood, we are constantly being introduced to new and exciting pools of romantic options. Even the advances in the past few years are pretty absurd. You can stand in line at the grocery store and swipe 60 people's faces on Tinder while you wait to buy hamburger buns. That's 20 times more people than my dad met on his marriage journey. Note, for those wondering, the best hamburger buns are Martin's potato rolls. Trust me. When you think about all this, you have to acknowledge something profound about the current situation. In the history of our species, no group has ever had as many romantic options as we have now. So, in theory, this should be a great thing. More options is better, right? Well, it's not that easy. Barry Schwartz is a professor of psychology at Swarthmore College who has spent much of his career studying the annoying problems that come from having an abundance of options. Schwartz's research, and a considerable amount of scholarship from other social scientists too, shows that when we have more options, we are actually less satisfied, and sometimes even have a harder time making a choice at all. When I thought back to that sad peanut butter and banana sandwich I had in Seattle, this idea resonated with me. Schwartz's way of thinking about choice grew popular when he published his book, The Paradox of Choice. But for decades, most people presumed the opposite. The more choices we had, the more likely we would be able to maximize our happiness. In the 1950s, the pioneering scholar Herbert Simon paved the way for people like Schwartz by showing that most of the time, people are not all that interested in getting the best possible option. Generally, Simon argued, people and organizations lack the time, knowledge, and inclination to seek out the best and are surprisingly content with a suboptimal outcome. Maximizing is just too difficult, so we wind up being satisficers, a term that combines satisfy and suffice. We may fantasize about having the best of something, but we usually are happy to have something that's good enough. According to Simon, people can be maximizers and satisficers in different contexts. For example, when it comes to, let's say, tacos, I'm a maximizer. I'll do a rigorous amount of research to make sure I'm getting the best taco I can find. Because for me, there is a huge difference in the taco experience. A satisficer will just get tacos wherever they see a decent taco stand and call it a day. I hate getting tacos with these people. Enjoy your nasty tacos, losers. If I'm picking gasoline for my car, though, I'm more of a satisficer. I drive into whatever gas station is close, load the cheapest shit I can to fill my tank, and get the fuck out of there. It sounds pretty mean to my car, but I really don't give a shit, and notice no difference in performance with the quality of gas. Sorry, Prius. Now, I understand that there is a certain kind of car guy out there who would find my choice of gasoline as horrifying as I find the choice of suboptimal tacos. To that I say, stop caring so much about gasoline, you ding-dong. Spend that money on good tacos, like a nice, normal person. What Schwartz suggests, however, is that cultural, economic, and technological changes since the time that Simon wrote have changed the choice-making context. Because of smartphones and the internet, our options are no longer limited to what's in the physical store where we are standing. We can choose from what's in every store, everywhere. We have far more opportunities to become maximizers than we would have had just a few decades ago. And that new context is changing who we are and how we live. I noticed this in myself with Christmas ornaments. Why would I be anything but a satisficer with Christmas ornaments? It's pretty standard. The balls, the string of lights, etc. Well, do some internet searching and you'll find some amazing ornaments. A Back to the Future DeLorean, little dinosaurs, a funny dude on a motorcycle. I ordered them all. These types of ornaments wouldn't have even entered my mind before the internet allowed me to see these other options. Now my standards for Christmas ornaments had gone up, and I wanted the best. Sadly, due to shipping delays, most of the ornaments I ordered arrived in late January, but my tree was extra dope in February. Besides gasoline, it's damn near impossible for me to think of anything where I won't put in time to find the best. I'm a maximizer in nearly everything. Bottled water? Yep. You buy one of the Bozo brands and you get bottled water that's just tap water in a bottle. Potato chips? Ruffles? No thank you. Pass the sweet onion kettle chips. Candles? If you only knew how good the candles in my house smell. It's so easy to find and get the best, so why not? What happens to people who look for and find the best? Well, it's bad news again. Schwartz, along with two business school professors, did a study of college seniors preparing to enter the workforce. For 6 months, the researchers followed the seniors as they applied for and started new jobs. They then classified the students into maximizers, students who were looking for the best job, and satisficers, students who were looking for a job that met certain minimum requirements and was good enough. Here's what they found. On average, the maximizers put much more time and effort into their job search. They did more research, asked more friends for advice, and went on more interviews. In return, the maximizers in the study got better jobs. They received, on average, a 20% higher starting salary than the satisficers. After they started their jobs, though, Schwartz and his colleagues asked the participants how satisfied they were. What they found was amazing. Even though the maximizers had better jobs than the satisficers, by every psychological measure, they felt worse about them. Overall, maximizers had less job satisfaction and were less certain they'd selected the right job at all. The satisficers, by contrast, were generally more positive about their jobs, the search process, and their lives in general. The satisficers had jobs that paid less money, but they somehow felt better about them. Searching for a job when you're in college is hardly a typical situation. So I asked Schwartz if perhaps this study was capturing something unique. It wasn't. Schwartz is an encyclopedia of psychological research on choice problems. If asked to give a quote about him for the back of a book cover, I would say, "This motherfucker knows choice." As he explained it, the maximizers in the job search experiment were doing what maximizers generally do. Rather than comparing actual jobs with their various pros and cons, in their minds they wound up selecting the features of each particular job and creating a fantasy job, an ideal that neither they nor probably anyone else would ever get. Johnny Satisficer is sitting around at his dum-dum job, eating his disgusting subpar taco and thinking about hanging his generic Christmas ornaments later on. But he's totally happy about that. Meanwhile, I've just found out the taco place I researched for hours is closed on Sundays, and even though this year I have my dope Christmas ornaments, I'm worried there's a better Christmas ornament out there that I don't know about yet, and I'm spending my holidays with the internet instead of my family. The paradox of choice in relationships. When applied to modern romance, the implications of these ideas on choice are slightly terrifying. If we are the generation with the greatest set of options, what happens to our decision-making? By Schwartz's logic, we're probably looking for the best, and in fact, we're looking for our soulmates too. Is this possible to find? How many people do you need to see before you know you found the best? Schwartz asked. The answer is every damn person there is. How else do you know it's the best? If you're looking for the best, this is a recipe for complete misery. Complete misery. If you were in a big city or on an online dating site, you were flooded with options. Seeing all these options, like the people in the job example, are we now comparing our potential partners not to other potential partners, but rather to an idealized person whom no one could measure up to? And what if you're not looking for your soulmate yet, but just want to date someone and commit to a girlfriend or boyfriend? How does our increase in options affect our ability to commit? To be honest, even picking lunch in Seattle was pretty tough. If we, like the people in the job study, are creating a fantasy person full of all our desired qualities, doesn't the vast potential of the internet and all our other romantic pools give us the illusion that this fantasy person does in fact exist? Why settle for anything less? When we brought up these ideas in focus groups, people responded to these notions immediately. In the city with arguably the most options, New York City, people discussed how it was hard to settle down because every corner you turn revealed more potential opportunities. I felt it myself. For much of the past few years, I split my time between New York and L.A. When I first started dating my current girlfriend, when I was in New York, I'd see people everywhere and feel like, shit, should I ever take myself out of the single world? There's so many people. Then I got back to L.A., where instead of walking in streets and subway stations full of potential options, I would be alone in my Prius, filled with shitty gasoline, listening to a dumb podcast. I couldn't wait to get home and hold my girlfriend. But the surge of options is not limited to people in New York. As Schwartz told me, where did people meet alternatives 30 years ago? It was in the workplace. How many shots did you have? Two or three people, maybe, who you found attractive, who were the right age, or you meet someone who your friend works with, and your friend fixes you up. So the set of romantic possibilities that you actually confront is going to be pretty small. And that, it seems to me, is like feeding in an environment where the food is relatively scarce. You find someone who seems simpatico, and you do as much as you can to cultivate that person because there may be a long drought after that person. That's what it used to be like. But now, he said, in principle, the world is available to you. The world is available to us, but that may be the problem. Columbia professor Sheena Iyengar, who we've met, was one of Barry Schwartz's co-authors on the job hunting study, and she also knows a shit ton about choice. Through a series of experiments, Iyengar has demonstrated that an excess of options can lead to indecision and paralysis. In one of her most influential studies, she and another researcher set up a table at a luxury food store and offered shoppers samples of jams. Sometimes the researchers offered 6 types of jam, but other times they offered 24. When they offered 24, people were more likely to stop in and have a taste. But strangely, they were far less likely to actually buy any jam. People who stopped to taste the smaller number of jams were almost 10 times more likely to buy jam than people who stopped to taste the larger number. Don't you see what's happening to us? There's just too much jam out there. If you're on a date with a certain jam, you can't even focus, because as soon as you go to the bathroom, 3 other jams have texted you. You go online, you see more jam there. You put in filters to find the perfect jam. There are iPhone apps that literally tell you if there is jam nearby that wants to get eaten at that particular moment. Limited options. Journeys to Wichita and Monroe. Would forcing us to select from fewer options, as older generations did, actually make us happier? Should we all just follow my dad's example and find someone of an ideal height and lock it down? I decided to get out of New York City and explore some places with limited options. My 2 stops, Monroe, New York, and Wichita, Kansas. Monroe is about 60 miles outside of New York City. It's home to approximately 8,000 people. It's a small community where most everyone knows one another. There's nothing but strip malls and second-tier grocery chains you never see elsewhere. If you click on the Attractions tab on TripAdvisor's Monroe page, it brings up a message that says, "I'm sorry, you must have clicked here by mistake. No one could possibly be planning a trip to Monroe to see its attractions. I have a feeling about why you'd want to go to Monroe. Here, let me redirect you to a suicide prevention site." Basically, not much is going on. Wichita is much, much bigger than Monroe. Its population is about 385,000. A quick Google search will show you many articles saying Wichita is one of the worst dating cities in the country. Granted, there isn't any scientific merit to these surveys, but the conditions used to gain this ranking make sense. There is a low proportion of single people, and strikingly few venues where single people can gather, places like bars and coffee shops. The town is quite isolated and doesn't get much traffic from nearby towns. One thing to note about people who live in places with limited options is that they get married young, whereas in places like New York City and Los Angeles, the average age at first marriage is now around 30. In smaller towns and less populated states, the typical age of first marriage for women is as low as 23 in Utah, 24, Idaho and Wyoming, or 25, a whole bunch of states, including Arkansas, Oklahoma, Alaska, and Kansas. Men in these states tend to marry just a year or two later than women. Could the lack of options be forcing these people to commit earlier and get into serious relationships? Perhaps, but this doesn't always work out either. In recent decades, the divorce rate in small towns and rural areas has skyrocketed, catching up to the levels commonly found in large cities. So many of the people I met in Wichita told me about friends of theirs who'd married before the age of 25 and then divorced soon after. Heather, for instance, was only 24, but she could already report that a lot of my sorority pledge sisters got married and divorced within a year. Within a year? Damn. Let's hope things don't end like that for me and the carefully researched electric juicer I just purchased. Before our interviews, I had romanticized the dating cities with fewer options and envisioned a happier, smaller community where people really got to know one another, and instead of hopping around trying to find the best party, they all just went to their one local spot and had a good time. I imagined every guy had a girl next door. They grew up together, got to know each other their whole lives, and had a really deep bond. One day, they just started boning, and then they got married. I'm basing that on nothing, but it seems correct, right? But talking with so many single people in Monroe and Wichita quickly demolished my fantasy that things were simpler and nicer in small towns. They generally hated their lack of options and the troubles that came with it. Despite the difference in size, the problems of dating in Wichita and Monroe overlapped quite a bit. All our singles in both cities felt pressure to lock it down and definitely felt like outliers by being single in their late 20s. The stigma of being unmarried in your late 20s was never expressed in any of the focus groups in bigger cities. A huge problem is that everyone already knows all of his or her options pretty well. Josh, 22, said his main pool of dating options is generally limited to a set of folks that he and his friends have known since high school. If I see a girl at a bar and I don't know her, within 30 seconds to a minute, I'll find out who that person is just by asking around, he explained. Her life story, who she's dated, you basically know everything about the person. And from talking to these folks, it appears when you don't know someone already, usually the everything is not, "Oh, he or she is the best, brilliant, hilarious, and without any baggage or complicated past to speak of, strange you never met." No, it's probably closer to, "Oh, him? He steals tires and then sells them on eBay to buy corn chips." In Wichita, I met Miguel, who had moved from Chicago. He mourned the fact that he never met new people anymore. In Chicago, he would meet all kinds of people. Friends of friends, co-workers, friends of co-workers, and strangers whom he talked up in bars and cafes and even on public transit. In Wichita, though, Miguel said he mainly saw the few folks he worked with and spent his evenings with the same group of friends. This cliquish mentality was reported in both Monroe and Wichita. One guy in Wichita described it like the gangs and the warriors. People have their cliques, and they rarely stray outside of them to meet new people. This leads to a lot of people dating their way through the same small groups, and after they've dated everyone, they're left in a bad spot. Finding new people isn't easy when no one new is coming to town. Sometimes people think they've discovered a new person, only to discover that they share more connections than they realized. In both Monroe and Wichita, we heard stories of people meeting someone they thought was a new person, but then going on Facebook and seeing 48 mutual friends. A girl named Heather told me that one time she met a great guy she'd never seen before and was really excited about the possibilities, only to discover that he'd once slept with a girl she totally despised. This soured the whole thing. The girl? Actress Gwyneth Paltrow. Not really, but can you imagine? Soon afterward, a guy named Greg recounted a story of going out with a girl. On the date, they started sharing stories of how they'd lost their virginity. He soon figured out that the guy she'd lost her virginity to was a close friend and co-worker of his. That co-worker? Football star O.J. Simpson. Not really, but again, could you imagine? How weird would it be to sleep with someone who lost their virginity to O.J. Simpson? Weird. It's like a cesspool, said Michelle, a 26-year-old from Monroe. Everybody has slept with each other. Also, when you're going out with people in such a limited pool of options, issues I'd never thought of came up. One, when you go out on a date, you will run into everyone you know, so sometimes singles travel for a little privacy. I went on a date last night, but it was in a totally different town, a 21-year-old Monroe resident named Emily told us. I would never go on a first date somewhere in my town because I know all the waiters, I know all the bartenders, I know everybody. Two, you lose the initial discovery period of getting to know someone because you are so connected and familiar already. This can be an advantage and a disadvantage. The advantage is you get to pre-screen everyone through friends of friends, but the downside is that you lose that fun of getting to know someone. In Monroe, Emily reported, you already know their life story, so you don't even have to go on a first date. You've already prejudged them before you've even gone out. And finally, if you do go out with someone and it goes badly, you have to deal with the fact that you're going to see that person all the time. Compare this with a place like Los Angeles, where Ryan, 23, said that he could go out with someone and, if it went badly, be fairly confident he would never see them again. It was almost like they were dead. Like, in a way, you murdered them in your mind, he said. Damn, Ryan, let's chill on the mind murders. But I understand his sentiment. But what about the expanding pool of options with the internet and other social media? Were any of these singles using online dating, smartphone swipe apps? In Wichita, people were shyer about online dating. There was still a stigma, and with such a small pool, there was a worry that people would see your profile and judge you. Josh, from Monroe, decided to give Tinder a try. I set the range for 10 miles at first because I want to make this quick. Two people pop up, and I'm like, no. He swiped his finger to the left. No. He swiped again. And then it was done. And I was like, damn, I thought there'd be more. Can I get those back? Others had more luck. Margaret, one of the few Wichita singles who had tried online dating, said, I think that the online dating thing, what I'm finding, is that there's so much choice. I'm like, oh my God, all these guys could be great. Another dater also tried Tinder. I started in Wichita, but ran out of people after just a week or so. I then went to Pennsylvania, near Penn State University, for a few days and decided to test it out there. I felt like I could swipe through people for years. This just showed me how limited options were in Kansas. Of course, not everyone was disappointed by the lack of options in these small towns. One gentleman in the Monroe group, Jimmy, age 24, had a more positive attitude. Whenever someone expressed frustration with the lack of options in the dating scene, Jimmy would insist that you simply needed to invest time in people to really get to know them. If you're patient and you know what you like, you'll find what you like in another person. There's going to be things you don't like about them. They don't clip their toenails, they don't wash their socks. I told Jimmy I felt like he could find someone with clean socks and trim toenails, and maybe the bar was set a bit too low. The point is, there's always going to be something that bothers you, you know? But it's up to you, he said. This positive attitude was echoed in Wichita as well. I feel optimistic about Wichita, said Greg, 26. I know that there's people here that would surprise me. You have to put a little bit more effort into the relationship, but it's still there somewhere. I agree, said James, 24. There's still gold here. You just have to look hard enough. It was a beautiful thing to hear. The attitude of these guys was to give people a chance. Instead of sampling a bunch of jams, they had learned how to focus on one jam and make sure they could appreciate it before they walked away. The more I thought about that approach to dating, the more appealing it became. No matter how many options we have, the real challenge is figuring out how to evaluate them. After my conversations in Monroe and Wichita, I thought about how popular online dating is in New York City and L.A., how almost everyone in all the focus groups there use the sites, and the stories like the woman who was Tindering on her way to a date to try to find a better date afterward. Maybe we are turning into the people from the job study, trying to find a crazy, unattainable job. Maybe we are trying to meet every single person in order to be sure we have the best. Maybe we have it all wrong. Maybe we need to have a little more faith in humanity, like our positive buds in Wichita and Monroe. Look at my dad. He had an arranged marriage, and he seems totally happy. I looked into it, and this is not uncommon. People in arranged marriages start off lukewarm, but over time they really invest in each other, and in general have more successful relationships. They're more invested in the deep commitment to the relationship rather than being personally invested in finding a soulmate, which can tend to lead to the, is there something better out there for me, mentality. Analyzing our options. Even before deciding to go on a date, our ways of analyzing our options are getting brutal. As a woman in LA told me about the flood of options she saw as an online dater, it's fun, but it also opens up this door to be more and more and more picky and analytical. I was exchanging messages with the guy, and he mentioned that he listens to Kevin and Bean in the morning. And it was like, okay, you're done. One radio show choice had killed any chance of this relationship prospering. Somewhere, that guy is sitting alone in his car, listening to Kevin and Bean, staring at his last conversation with this woman and wondering, where did it all go wrong? Of course, these kinds of deal breakers end up making their way into the picture even if a contender does make it to a first date. One of the problems with a first date is that you know very little about a person, so you overweight those few things that you do know, the anthropologist and dating guru Helen Fisher told me. And suddenly, you see they've got brown shoes, and you don't like brown shoes, so they're out. Or they don't like your haircut, so they're out. But if you were to get to know each other, those particular characteristics might begin to recede in importance, as you also found that they had a great sense of humor or they'd love to go fishing in the Caribbean with you. Our boring-ass dates. How do we go about analyzing our options? On dates, and most of the time, boring-ass dates. You have coffee, drinks, a meal, go see a movie. We're all trying to find someone who excites us, someone who makes us feel like we've truly made a connection. Can anyone reach that high bar on the typical boring dates we all go on? One of the social scientists I consulted for this book is the Stanford sociologist Rob Willer. Willer said that he had several friends who had taken dates to a monster truck rally. If you aren't familiar with monster truck rallies, basically these giant-ass trucks with names like Skull Crusher and the Rejuvenator ride up huge dirt hills and do crazy jumps. Okay, I made up Rejuvenator, but it would be cool if there were a Jewish monster truck scene. Sometimes they fly over a bunch of smaller cars or even school buses. Even more nuts, sometimes those trucks assemble into a giant robot truck that literally eats cars. Not joking, it's called Truckzilla, and it's worth looking into. Frankly, it sounds cool as shit, and I'm looking at tickets for the next one I can attend. Anyway, for Willer's friends, it started as a plan to do something campy and ironic, since they weren't big car and truck fans so much as curious about this interesting and kind of bizarre subculture. It turned out to be a great date event. Fun, funny, exciting, and different. Instead of the usual boring resume exchange, the couples were placed in an interesting environment and got to really get a sense of their own rapport. Two of the couples he mentioned were still together and happily dating. Sadly, another one of the couples was making out in a small car that was soon run over and destroyed by a monster truck named King Crush. Very unfortunate. In one of our subreddit threads, we asked people to tell us about their best first dates, and it was amazing to see how many involved doing things that are easy and accessible but require just a bit more creativity than dinner and a movie. One gentleman wrote, I took her to an alpaca farm after she said she thought they were the cutest things. After sweet-talking the farm owner, he let us walk into the barn where all the little guys overcame their initial trepidation and then surrounded us in the most adorable way possible. After nuzzling them for an hour, we went to Taco Bell. I burned myself horribly on an apple empanada, but it got her to laugh, so I'll chalk that one up as a win. I was 18, the whole date cost about $7, and I got her to smile a bunch, so yeah, that was great. Here's another animal story. His parents both work in media, and every year he goes to the Westminster Dog Show at Madison Square Garden and finds his way backstage through a combination of walking with a purpose and flashing media credentials his parents help with. Talk about impressing a first date! We then bought wine, which they served out of sippy cups, and made a drinking game out of the dog show. Take a drink every time a dog jumps when it's not supposed to, and so on. Dating aside, I'm definitely playing a Westminster Dog Show drinking game ASAP. That sounds fun. And here's one that involved the most typical activity imaginable, but with a simple wardrobe twist that transformed everything. It was just dinner and drinks. I showed up to the restaurant, and he was in a full beekeeper suit, just sitting slash chilling at the table waiting for me. It was the total icebreaker. I laughed so hard, in an endearing way. The staff seemed confused, and some people at neighboring tables were laughing. One guy, about my age, asked if we were on a reality show. We talked about his bees and honey and the little honey business he's starting up. He even brought little honey samples for me to try. Ha ha. And I did, and it was delicious. We had a great dinner and great conversation. He told me he was having a great time and asked if I wanted to go for a drink sometime. I said sure. He pulled out his phone and texted me at the table. Hey, are you free for a drink tonight? I found that so sweet and silly. I texted him back and we totally went for drinks. Now granted, I'm not saying that we should all show up on dates wearing beekeeper suits. The dates that are not boring are not all super eccentric things. The common thread is that they weren't just resume exchanges over a drink or dinner. They were situations in which people could experience interesting things together and learn what it was like to be with someone new. The effects of non-boring-ass dates. There is social science that shows that more interesting dates like this can lead to more romantic success. In their famous 1974 study called Some Evidence for Heightened Sexual Attraction Under Conditions of High Anxiety, Arthur Aaron and Don Dutton sent an attractive woman to the Capilano River in Vancouver, Canada. The river runs through a deep canyon, across which were two bridges. One of the bridges, the control bridge, was very sturdy. It was constructed of heavy cedar, had high handrails, and ran only about 10 feet above the water. The second bridge, the experimental bridge, was much, much scarier. It was made of wooden boards attached to wire cables and had a tendency to tilt and sway. The handrails were low, and if you fell, it was a 200-foot drop onto rocks and shallow rapids. Of the two bridges, only the second was, neurologically speaking, arousing. The researchers had the attractive woman approach men as they crossed each of the bridges. She then told the men she was doing a psychological study and asked if they'd take a brief survey. Afterward, she gave the men her phone number and told them to call if they had any additional questions about the experiment. The researchers predicted that men on the shaky bridge would be more likely to call, as they might mistake their arousal, actually caused by fear, for romantic arousal caused by attraction to the woman. Sure enough, more men on the shaky bridge made the call. Must have been a bummer for those dudes, though. Hey, Sharon, it's Dave from the bridge study. I know this may sound weird, but I was wondering, would you like to grab a cup of coffee or something sometime? No, David, sorry, this isn't Sharon, this is Martin. I'm a lab assistant. This was actually also part of the study. We wanted to see if you'd be more likely to call Sharon if you were on the more precarious bridge. And you were! This is great! Oh. Okay. Do you know how to get in touch with Sharon? No, I don't. This is the decoy number we gave all of you guys. Man, she is something though, huh? Alright, thanks again. Bye, David. Bye. Aaron published another study titled Couples Shared Participation in Novel and Arousing Activities and Experienced Relationship Quality. Damn, dude, shorten the names of your studies. Where he took 60 couples who were doing okay and had them A, participate in activities that were novel and exciting, skiing or hiking, B, participate in activities that were pleasant slash mundane, dinner, movie, or C, participate in no activity. This was the control group. The couples that did the novel and exciting activities showed a significantly greater increase in relationship quality. Now, many of you are probably thinking that this directly contradicts a study cited by Keanu Reeves' character at the end of the film Speed. I've heard relationships based on intense experiences never work, he says. Okay, replies Sandra Bullock's character. We'll have to base it on sex then. I'm not sure where Keanu's character, Jack Traven, got his information, but if you trust that Aaron and his colleagues aren't bullshitting us, seems like participating in novel and exciting activities increases our attraction to people. Do the dates you usually go on line up more with the mundane slash boring or the exciting slash novel variety? If I look back on my dating life, I wonder how much better I, and the other person, would have fared if I'd done something exciting, rather than just get a stupid drink at a local bar. So, maybe for your next date, think it through and plan it out perfectly. Instead of dinner at a nice restaurant, go to dinner at a nice restaurant, but hire some actors who can do solid German accents to show up and fake an 80s Die Hard-style terrorist takeover of the place to create the danger effect seen in the Shaky Bridge study. Then, after you narrowly escape, go outside and see that the road you have to take is super hilly and very dangerous. That's when you say, maybe we should take my ride. You point her to your car. That's right, the monster truck, Gravedigger. After that, you ride home, where you leap over dozens of cars and shoot fire from the sides of your tires. Your date will be excited in no time. More boring-ass dates? The quality of dates is one thing, but what about the quantity? When thinking about that question, I recalled a change I made in my own personal dating policy at one point. While I was single in New York, the city of options, I found myself and a lot of my friends just exploring as many options as we could. There were a lot of first dates, but not as many third dates. We were consistently choosing to meet as many people as possible instead of investing in a relationship. The goal was seemingly to meet someone who instantly swept us off our feet, but it just didn't seem to be happening. I felt like I was never meeting people I really, really liked. Was everyone shitty, or was I shitty? Maybe I was okay, but my dating strategy was shitty. Maybe I was kind of shitty, and my dating strategy was kind of shitty, too. At a certain point, I decided to change my dating strategy as a personal experiment. I would invest more in people and spend more time with one person. Rather than go on four different dates, what if I went on four dates with one person? If I went out with a girl, and the date felt like it was a six, normally I wouldn't have gone on a second date. Instead, I would have been on my phone texting other options, trying to find that elusive first date that would be a 9 or a 10. With this new mentality, I would go on a second date. What I found is that a first date that was a 6 was usually an 8 on the second date. I knew the person better, and we kept building a good rapport together. I discovered things about them that weren't initially apparent. We developed more inside jokes and just generally get along better, because we were familiar. Just casually dating many people had rarely led to this kind of discovery. In the past, I had probably been eliminating folks who could have possibly provided fruitful relationships, short or long term, if I had just given them more of a chance. Unlike my enlightened friend in Monroe, I just hadn't had enough faith in people. Now I felt much better. Instead of trying to date so many different people and getting stressed out with texting games and the like, I was really getting to know a few people and having a better time for it. After doing the research for this book and spending time reading papers with long-ass titles like Couples Shared Participation in Novel and Arousing Activities and Experienced Relationship Quality, I realized the results of my personal experiment were quite predictable. Initially, we are attracted to people by their physical appearance and traits we can quickly recognize. But the things that really make us fall for someone are their deeper, more unique qualities, and usually those only come out during sustained interactions. In a fascinating study published in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology, University of Texas psychologists Paul Eastwick and Lucy Hunt show that in most dating contexts, a person's mate value matters less than their unique value. The authors explain that they define mate value as the average first impression of how attractive someone is, based largely on things like looks, charisma, and professional success, and unique value as the extent to which someone rates a specific person above or below that average first impression. For instance, they explain the unique value of a man they call Neil like this. Even if Neil is a 6 on average, certain women may vary in their impressions of him. Amanda fails to be charmed by his obscure literary references and thinks he is a 3. Yet Eileen thinks he is a 9. She finds his illusions captivating. In most cases, people's unique traits and values are difficult to recognize, let alone appreciate, in an initial encounter. There are just too many things going through our minds to fully take in what makes that other person special and interesting. People's deeper and more distinctive traits emerge gradually through shared experiences and intimate encounters. The kind we sometimes have when we give relationships a chance to develop, but not when we serially first date. No wonder that, as Eastwick and Hunt report, most people do not initiate romantic relationships immediately after forming first impressions of each other, but instead do it gradually when an unexpected or perhaps long-awaited spark transforms a friendship or acquaintance into something sexual and serious. According to one recent study, only 6% of adolescents in romantic relationships say they got together soon after meeting. The number is surely much higher among adults, especially now that online dating is so prevalent, but even people who meet through Tinder or OkCupid are much more likely to turn a random first date into a meaningful relationship if they follow the advice of our Monroe friend Jimmy, There's something uniquely valuable in everyone, and we'll be much happier and better off if we invest the time and energy it takes to find it. But seriously, if the person doesn't clip their toenails or wear clean socks, look elsewhere. There are plenty of options. Chapter 5. International Investigations of Love. When I decided to write this book, one of the things I really wanted to explore was how the different issues in modern romance manifested themselves in other countries. My interest in this started one night when I was doing stand-up in a small club in New York. I was talking about texting, and I asked for a volunteer who'd met someone recently and had been texting back and forth with them. I read the back and forth messages of one gentleman and made jokes about how we were all dealing with some version of this nonsense. I quickly noticed that one woman seemed very puzzled. I asked her why she looked so bewildered, and she explained that this was something that just didn't happen in France, where she was from. This kind of back and forth simply didn't exist, she claimed. I asked her, okay, well, what would a guy in France text you if you met him at a bar? She said he would write, fancy a fuck? I said, whoa, what would you write back? She said, I would write yes or no, depending on whether I fancied one or not. I was stunned. That kind of makes so much more sense, right? Internationally, there's a huge variety of dating cultures that have their own quirks and dilemmas. Our interviews in Doha were interesting and made me excited about the possibilities of researching dating in other cultures. Obviously, we couldn't study all of them, so Eric and I had to be very selective about where we went. After a lot of debate, the places we landed on were Paris, Tokyo, and Buenos Aires. The reason for Paris is obvious. It's the city of love, blah, blah, blah. Also, relationships in Paris are similar to what we'd read about in other European countries, where dating as we know it in America is not really part of the culture. People hang out in groups of friends, and if they want to start a relationship with someone, they just do it. They are also a bit more casual about sex, and have a different attitude toward infidelity, as we will see in the next chapter. Tokyo was the next place I suggested. This was done less in the interest of the book and more in the interest of me enjoying delicious ramen. However, after discussing the idea with Eric, we realized Tokyo was a great place to go because Japan is going through a crisis of sorts. Marriage and birth rates are in a huge decline. Many young people are showing a lack of interest in romance, and also, again, I love ramen. It was clear Tokyo was a great choice, both for the book and our tummies. While Japan is experiencing a decline in sexual interest, we also wanted to see the other extreme, so we went to explore the romantically aggressive culture of Buenos Aires. There's a good reason that Buenos Aires is often called the world's best city for dating. PDA is rampant. People are dancing in sweaty clubs until 8 or 9 in the morning. Sex is everywhere you look. So, there's our itinerary. While we couldn't go everywhere, these places all provided a uniquely interesting take on modern romance around the world. Okay, let's go. First stop, Tokyo. Tokyo, the land of herbivores and tengas. My initial thought was that Tokyo would have a highly active dating scene. It is a booming metropolis, throbbing with life and energy, arguably even more so than New York. You have everything, the tastiest restaurants, the coolest stores, and the weirdest stuff that you can't find anywhere else in the world. An entire arcade filled with nothing but photo booths? Yep. A vending machine that grows and sells fresh heads of lettuce? Yep. A restaurant with a dinner show where bikini-clad dancers ride in on huge robots and tanks? What else do you think goes down at the robot restaurant in Shinjuku? Plus, I'd heard rumors of love hotels, which are what they sound like, hotels specifically built for hooking up. But of course, this being Japan, they sometimes have really amazing decor. There's even a Jurassic Park-themed one. Seriously, this exists. I am not joking. At night, the neon signs turn the city into an adult adventureland. The streets, bars, and clubs are raucous and busy. Something fun and interesting is lurking in every nook and cranny. You can wander onto the third floor of an office building and find an amazing high-end cocktail bar behind one door, a record store behind another, and past the hallway, a bizarre nightclub filled with Japanese men wearing Bill Clinton masks, giving back rubs to dogs. Walk through many of the big neighborhoods often enough, and you are bound to stumble upon a little hidden corner with sex stores and the aforementioned love hotels, which are actually nice, clean hotels that rent by the hour and are used by couples to pop in and do their thing. Upon first glance, the city closest to Tokyo in terms of dating infrastructure would seem to be New York. I also assumed the tech-obsessed Japanese were probably on the next level of dating websites and apps. These people invented emojis, for God's sakes. They were texting and they thought, yeah, this is great, but it'd be really dope to be able to send a small image of a koala bear, too. If the Japanese dude who decides what emojis go on the iPhone is listening to this, can I make a plea for a turbanless brown guy emoji? Would be very useful for me. No offense to the turban dude emoji or any real-life dudes who wear turbans, who are surely grateful for that emoji's existence. Who knew what their texting back and forth would look like? I couldn't wait to do our interviews and see what kind of stuff was going on. It all seemed ideal for the perfect dating city, but I could not have been more off. All my assumptions were wrong. Start doing even the slightest research into Japan and love, and you'll quickly find sensational articles describing a full-blown crisis. According to demographers, journalists, and even the Japanese government, it's a hot potato. Sorry, I needed another word for crisis, and when I entered the word crisis into thesaurus.com, it suggested hot potato as a synonym. I could not write this book without letting you know that thesaurus.com lists hot potato as a synonym for crisis. Hey, did you hear about what's happening with Israel and Palestine? It's becoming a real hot potato. Anyway, back to Japan. You read these articles and they are just filled with panicky language. No one's fucking! No one's getting married and having kids! Young people aren't interested in boning anymore! Those aren't direct quotes, but that's pretty much what you read. It sounded alarmist to me. Young people are just not interested in sex? How could that be possible? Let's bust out some scary-ass statistics. In 2013, a whopping 45% of women aged 16 to 24 were not interested in or despised sexual contact, and more than a quarter of men felt the same way. I've always wanted to describe a statistic as whopping, and I think we can concur this is indeed whopping. Seriously, let's listen to those numbers one more time. 45% of women aged 16 to 24 were not interested in or despised sexual contact. The number of men and women between 18 and 34 who are not involved in any romantic relationship with the opposite sex has risen since 1987, from 49% to 61% for men, and from 39% to 49% for women. A whopping one-third of Japanese people under 30 have never dated, and in a survey of those between 35 and 39, more than a quarter reported that they'd never even had sex. Okay, that's the last whopping I'll use. Almost half of Japanese men and one-third of women in their early 30s were still single as of 2005. In 2012, 41.3% of married couples had not had sex in the past month, the highest percentage since the figures became available in 2004. There was a steady rise over the previous 10 years, from 31.9% in 2004. Japan's birth rate ranks 222nd out of 224 countries. A report compiled with the government's cooperation 2 years ago warned that by 2060, the number of Japanese will have fallen from 127 million to about 87 million, of whom almost 40% will be 65 or older. This last stat is particularly alarming. The Japanese are legitimately worried about running out of Japanese people. No more ramen? No more sushi? No more high-end Japanese whiskeys? You see how this is really a hot potato. The situation has reached a point where even the government has seen the need to step in. Since 2010, the Japanese state has paid parents a monthly allowance of between $100 and $150 per child to take some of the financial burden out of child raising. But before you can have a kid, you need to find someone to love and marry, right? Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe allocated $25 million in the 2014 fiscal budget for programs designed to get people to pair off and have babies, including government-funded dating services. An official survey conducted in 2010 showed that 66% of all prefecture governments and 33% of city, ward, town, and village governments were implementing some form of marriage support. Even more do so today. We asked the Japanese-American sociologist Kumiko Endo, who studies the new marriage support programs that the Japanese government has established, to give us some examples. In Niigata Prefecture, she said, marriage support events include tours, for example, a bus tour to a nearby shrine, cultural events like cooking classes, sports events, and seminars, coaching sessions for men while fishing. Saga Prefecture has set up a Department of Connection that fixes up singles who want to meet new people, and both Shizuoka and Akita Prefectures now provide internet communication services for singles, whom they inform about various parties and events for singles. some of which are supported by the government. Finally, Fukui Prefecture recently launched an online dating site called the Fukui Marriage Hunting Cafe, and couples meet on the site and many receive cash and gifts. The government is sending Japanese couples wedding presents? What on earth is happening there? Learning about this crisis, and remembering how much I was fiending for authentic ramen and all the other delights of Tokyo, it was clear I needed to hit the ground myself to find out what was happening. The history and current state of marriage in Tokyo. Before getting into the current situation in Japan, it's important to understand that Japan has also seen a large shift in how adults view and pursue the institution of marriage. My sociologist friend Kumiko explained to me that up until World War II, arranged marriages were more common than any other form of matrimony. Even in the 1960s, approximately 70% of all marriages were set up by families. In the 1970s, the workplace became a prime site for finding a mate. Large companies would organize social gatherings, and cultural norms dictated that most women would quit their posts after they married and started a family. Today, however, that system is a relic. Arranged marriages are uncommon, down to 6.2% as of 2005. Like the United States, Japan has adopted a more individualistic culture based on personal choice and happiness. The Japanese economy has been sluggish since the 1990s, and the modern workplace has become a site for stressful competition. It's no longer acting as a de facto singles bar for professionals. So if the old system is now broken, what has replaced it? Herbivore man. After arriving in Tokyo, I knew I had a limited amount of time to do what I needed to get done. Visit the five best ramen shops in the city. After eating my fill of ramen, it was time to get down to business. Visiting that robot restaurant, because, man, who could pass up an opportunity like that? Then, duty called. I also had to visit that Bill Clinton-masked dog back rub place. It was awesome. Then a quick nap, and finally, I started doing some research for this book. First, we organized some focus groups to discuss dating in Tokyo. Dozens of young adults in their mid-20s and early 30s spoke to us, or in most cases spoke to Kumiko, who translated their Japanese. Going in, one of the notions I was most curious about was the herbivore man. This is a term that has become ubiquitous in Japan over the past few years to describe Japanese men who are very shy and passive and show no interest in sex and romantic relationships. Surveys suggest that about 60% of male singles in their 20s and 30s in Japan identify themselves as herbivores. In the first group we held, one of the first to arrive was Akira. A good-looking young Japanese dude in a really sharp suit, Akira, 30, looked like he was probably doing well for himself. He seemed like a successful, confident young man. This guy wasn't a herbivore, right? We did interviews and focus groups with singles on four continents, and in most of them we broke the ice by asking people to tell us how many people they'd asked out or flirted with on their smartphones in the past few weeks. When we asked Akira that question, he just shrugged. Pretty much all the guys shrugged. Akira said he was working now and too busy to have a girlfriend. Several others we interviewed echoed the sentiment. I just got a job in construction, and there aren't many girls my age, so there's nowhere for me to meet them, said Daisaku, 21. His friend Hiro nodded. I'm busy with work, and it's not very urgent. I have to deal with work first, and that takes up my weekdays. I play video games when I go home. On the weekends, I hang out with Daisaku, and we go out drinking. Can't you meet women when you're out drinking? We asked. No, Hiro blushed. It's shirai. Kind of sleazy, in a playboy way. To try to pick up a woman you don't know. But also, if a girl said yes to me, I wouldn't want to go out there. I don't like girls who would want to be with a guy openly like that. Looking, smiling, winking. I want a girl who is saiso, pure. Pure, Eric asked, like a virgin? They laughed uncomfortably. Not exactly, Daisaku said, but it has to be someone with the right background, with the right family. If it was someone I just met somewhere, I'd be too embarrassed to tell my parents. They'd be disappointed. How did your parents meet? At work, Daisaku said. An arranged marriage, Hiro offered. This situation seems really difficult, Eric said. You want a girlfriend, and the women we meet want boyfriends, but no one knows how to make it happen. Do you feel like it's a problem? I don't really think anything about it, Hiro replied matter-of-factly. It's not a problem, and it's not a problem. It is what it is, because everyone's like that here. I don't even think about it because it's the norm. Akira said that he would only ask a woman out if it was clear without any doubt that she was interested. When I asked why, he said she could reject me, and every other guy in the room literally groaned in support. It was clear that the fear of rejection was huge, and much more so than I'd seen among men in America. I asked the women about the herbivore men, and whether they wished guys would take more initiative. It was a resounding yes. These women yearned for the men in Japan to step up and just ask them out. From their perspective, the men's extreme need for assurance and comfort from the women was irritating. Their frustration was palpable. You could see that they were indeed becoming what the press called the carnivorous woman. Some of these women described how they would now take the role more commonly played by Western men and approach Japanese men and ask for phone numbers. Wow, how charai of them, I thought, remembering the word I'd learned 3 minutes earlier. However, they said it wasn't always easy. They described how, even if they did meet a guy and engage with him, it was like an even more nightmarish version of the American guy who just keeps texting and doesn't ask a girl out. The text would keep going and going. He would just be so shy, and he just needs to feel so comfortable with you, one woman said. Unless men are really confident that the woman likes them back, they can't make the move, another lamented. As one man described it, they're waiting for the woman to be totally embracing of them before they make any kind of move. The fear of rejection even manifests itself in the phone world. I asked for an example of a back-and-forth text. A woman told me about one guy who had texted with her. The way she described it was that he was never really flirtatious. It would be very direct, impersonal things about movies he'd seen or his pets. One night he texted her and said, "I have this big head of cabbage. How should I cook this?" I asked if this was maybe a very, very lame roundabout dinner date invitation to ask her to come over for cabbage. "No, he was really asking me how to cook cabbage," she moaned. The same guy emailed her a few days later with this gem, and again, this is not a joke. "I recently got my futon wet and put it outside to dry, but it got caught in the rain, so now it's wet again." Wow, quite a suspenseful tale. What begat the rise of the herbivore man? There seems to be an almost perfect stew of social and economic ingredients that has cultivated the stereotype. Speaking of stew, while in Tokyo, I went to an izakaya called Kanamasu that had an amazing short rib dish. One of the most succulent... Okay, sorry, getting off track again. Social scientists argue that the herbivore man emerged with the decline of the Japanese economy. In Japanese culture, as in many cultures, men's confidence and sense of self is tied to their professional success. Everyone we talked to in Tokyo seemed to recall the booming 80s as a different era for romance, with salarymen flush with cash who could confidently approach a pretty woman and ask for her number without fear. This too is probably an exaggeration, but a telling one. With career jobs now gone, it's not only harder for men to meet a partner, but also harder for them to support her financially, so it makes sense that insecurity might leave men feeling more scared of rejection. Many single men also now live at home with their parents well into their 20s and 30s. The women in the focus groups felt that this situation only worsened a mothering complex already prevalent in Japanese culture. A man who lives at home can expect his mother to cook, clean, and do his laundry for him. The theory goes that guys are so used to being taken care of, they lose their manly instincts. On top of that, men in Japan are probably not as comfortable around women in general because they didn't grow up spending as much time with them. Much of the educational system in Japan is single-sex, and there's also sex segregation in co-ed schools. Physically, socially, and to some extent, psychologically, boys and girls grow up on separate tracks until at least high school, and often until college. Many people don't date until their 20s. Nearly 50% of the single guys in Japan don't even have friends of the opposite sex. When you combine the economic decline, men's infantilization by their mothers, their fear of rejection, and the lack of contact with the opposite sex throughout their lives, the herbivore man starts making a lot of sense. Now, I don't want to paint the picture that every Japanese guy is a super shy dude who has no interest in sex. There definitely seems to be a lot of that, but there are also plenty of Japanese men who are non-herbivores, who have dating lives that resemble those of the typical omnivorous American man. In our focus groups, we met Koji, a young bartender who seemed to be the most omnivorous of the bunch. The thing is, Koji wasn't some super stud or anything. Compared with the other guys, he was a little shorter. He wasn't dressed in a super sharp suit like Akira and the other professionals. He wore a gray vest and a brown fedora. What he had was a casualness and forthrightness to him that though fairly normal by American standards, really stood out in Japan. Those in the focus groups who knew Koji spoke of his seemingly mythical love life in hushed tones and were in awe of his confidence. Again, Koji was not some Asian Ryan Gosling figure. He just seemed to be comfortable with himself and not particularly shy. Like most fedora wearers, he had a lot of inexplicable confidence. He and another friend of his wanted to make sure we knew that there were some Japanese men who weren't herbivores and that maybe the media was blowing this out of proportion. Can I just speak for real? If I don't have a girlfriend, I can go and find someone to have sex with. I think those guys who say they're not having sex for a long time, I think they're bullshitting. They just don't want to talk about it, he said. If you're single in New York, you get on your phone and text people late at night and try to meet up with someone. There's a whole culture of a booty call. What's the process here, I asked. My friends and I do the same thing. I call all of them and no one will pick up. Well, the same thing happens in New York sometimes too, I said. At the same time Japanese men are undergoing a transformation, a new kind of Japanese woman is emerging as well. Historically, educated women would get office jobs after university, meet men there, and then leave the job to become wives and mothers. Now, women are pushing back, and more educated women want to work. They learn skills, like speaking English. They travel the world. They pursue careers of their own. These professional women don't want to conform to the old norm of being the submissive woman who abandons her own career ambitions to be a housewife. However, being educated, speaking English, and having a good job seem to intimidate some men, with some women even describing their success as a turnoff for their would-be suitors. Men here, they have high pride, one woman told me. They don't want a successful woman who makes a pretty good salary. The minute they find out I'm bilingual, they're like, oh no. By the end of our focus groups, it was pretty clear that Japanese men and women are on different trajectories. Women are still far from equal, but they are beginning to establish themselves in the Japanese economy, and they are gaining all sorts of rights and privileges in the culture as well. Men are struggling to hold on to their status, whether in the workplace or in the family. They've fallen from the heights of previous generations and are having trouble figuring out what to do next. Some are clearly so confused that they have taken to wearing fedoras. A difficult period indeed. A rice cooker as a profile pic. Welcome to online dating in Japan. Given the state of Japanese dating culture, you would think online dating would be a perfect solution. Sending a message to a potential mate on a website is much less intimidating than asking someone for their number in a bar, right? What better way to mitigate your fear of rejection? The Japanese are also notorious early adopters. If one-third of U.S. marriages are now formed by people meeting online, you'd guess that even more Japanese marriages began digitally. But although the rise of online dating could be very helpful in Japan, alas, it is not to be. The concerns about being perceived as charai, sleazy playboy type, extend into the social media world as well. And some of the necessary facets of online dating are frowned upon in Japan. Consider profile pictures. Dating online requires self-promotion. A dating profile is a kind of advertisement, a way of marketing yourself to prospective partners. But this attitude doesn't really fit well with Japanese culture. In Japan, posting any pictures of yourself, especially selfie-style photos, comes off as really douchey. Kana, an attractive single 29-year-old, remarked, "All the foreign people who use selfies on their profile pic, the Japanese feel like that's so narcissistic." In her experience, pictures on dating sites would generally include more than two people. Sometimes a person wouldn't be in the photo at all. I asked what they would post instead. "A lot of Japanese use their cats," she said. "They're not in the photo with the cat?" I asked. "Nope, just the cat. Or their rice cooker." I once saw a guy posted a funny street sign, volunteered Rinko, 33. I felt like I could tell a lot about the guy from looking at it. This kind of made sense to me. If you post a photo of something interesting, maybe it gives some sense of your personality. I showed a photo of a bowl of ramen I had taken earlier in the day and asked what she thought of that as a profile picture. She just shook her head. "Oh, I guess I can't hold a candle to that street sign, dude, huh?" Machikan and Gokan. So online dating is not taking off. What else? There is a traditional group date called a Gokan, where a guy invites a few guy friends and a girl invites a few girlfriends, and the group goes out for dinner and drinks. But even at these gatherings, women report that most guys are too shy to ask for their numbers. For an exchange to happen, the host would have to announce, "Okay, everyone, let's all exchange numbers." I actually participated in a Gokan in Tokyo once as part of a travel piece for GQ magazine. Unfortunately, the women they selected did not speak English, and I was armed only with the Japanese phrase for, "Do you like pizza?" By the end of the evening, filled with delicious yakitori, grilled meats, and beer, most of the women thought I had a story arc as